Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. My guest today is Karen Hudes, or Hudes, or I think I forget what it is, but she's not here just yet. She's on her way home from seeing her parents, I believe, and will be on Skype soon enough. In the meantime, a little bit of New Zealand news for you. John Banks is a person that I hate a lot. And not for petty reasons that he's just not nice to me or anything like that. It's more because he's really, really corrupt and, like, evil and is really rude to everybody, basically, unless you're willing to... I hate FCC regulations. I was going to make some kind of disgusting sexual reference. But, yeah, he's a really, really nasty, unhappy character. And at the moment, he's under private prosecution in the New Zealand courts because he is allegedly guilty of electoral fraud. Now, electoral fraud, for those of you who are not, you know, up to it, is a very serious crime. Like, if you take a shockingly large amount of money that's donated to you by somebody like, I don't know, Kim.com, for example, and you don't declare that that money was given to you as a campaign contribution from somebody, that's illegal. So naturally, because he's part of the criminal cabal that runs this country, he just decided to take it and not declare it. And now he might be facing the consequences. And this is a really heartening to me, because it proves that you can indeed individually wind up getting justice. I mean, think about this. We've got Graham McCready, who is leading this private prosecution against the Honourable John Banks. And he is going to... I'm told that I'm breaking up somewhat here. If we give me a second, I'll see if I can just adjust this right now, because there's a whole bunch of things uploading and what have you, and it'll break up my signal, something chronic. So I'm just going to pause all of these little uploads here, and hopefully that should clear up the signal somewhat. Okay, now. I'm not sure if people can hear me very well here, but you know, I'm getting to it, man. Just you know, just be patient. I really don't like John Banks. I go so far as to, you know, how some people say, "Oh, well, hate is such a strong word for John Banks." I think it's a very appropriate word. You know, I mean, the term scumbaggery was practically made for him. And people like him. He's just really, really just a bad dude. And so naturally, because he's a bad dude, he winds up getting himself into really, really lucrative positions of power, like being the mayor of Auckland, for example, or the leader of the opposition party, for example. He's one of the linchpins that allows the government to get away with perpetrating copious quantities of scumbaggery. All right, there's the thing right there, because if John Banks goes down and the government is now no longer capable of counting on their coalition partner, which basically okays and rubber stamps everything that they pass through under urgency, they might not be able to continue doing so. You know, you strike at the weakest target. I mean, if you're a lion and you want to, you know, gobble up yourself a nice, tasty gazelle burger, you go for the weakest little gazelle, you know? And that's what John Banks is now. We are the lions. We're roaring. And we're going to devour him. Because he's just that delicious to rip apart the rib cage and whatnot. Now, I think that although I'm very happy about this, and I get some kind of a sick fascination by seeing scumbaggery get exposed. I'm also very tentative in thinking about, how effective is this actually going to be? I mean, really, really. You have a look at the New Zealand court system, as Vince Seymour from KiwisFirst.co.nz has exposed, that a lot of the judges are related, and there's no court of record. Like, you're not allowed to keep records in a courtroom. Well, not most of the time it doesn't happen. And even if it does happen and you find out that the judge is being corrupt, or the or there's some form of scumbaggery going down inside the courtroom, suddenly those records just magically disappear. You know, because the corruption in this country is total. All right, total. No, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. All right. We may as well be ruled by Robert Mugabe. That's how corrupt this country of New Zealand is. And people don't understand that, because when they walk down the street and they get busted by cops and you can't just bribe the cops or whatever, they think that, oh, well, suddenly, you know, there's no corruption of any kind. It's not like in Bali where you get caught with 50 grams of weed or something like that and you just give the police officer a big wad of cash and he just looks the other way. Doesn't happen like that here in New Zealand. It's not that kind of corruption. It's high-level corruption, okay? Top-down corruption. There's some very, 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 very intricate stories that have been coming out from all sorts of people that, more or less, if you're a high-powered politician in this country, the likelihood that you're not taking backhanders or facilitating some kind of corrupt New World Order agenda is pretty slim, Jim. All right, pretty slim. And even if you are a good politician who tends to be honest, there'll be lots of things that you won't want to talk about, right? Because they're the truth, right? And if you're a politician, telling the truth is like smacking yourself in the head with a ball peen hammer. It's suicide, you know? Have you noticed that? How sad that situation is, that telling the truth in politics is akin to political suicide. All right? That's the unfortunate business that we wind up having to accept at this particular juncture in time, because of the fact the whole system's corrupt. Right? You have this very, very massive apparatus in Parliament that is set up specifically so that if any good apples get in there, the bad barrel corrupts them. All right? You have a look at the protocols, training, and what have you for new politicians. And there's all this red tape. So even if you were a good person getting into Parliament, the red tape prevents you from doing the right things, because you're not allowed to. You're just physically not allowed to do the right thing. That's Parliament in New Zealand anyway. And I'm not entirely convinced that it's any different in any of the other first world nations around the world. You know, you get elected, you're like, yeah, I'm going to do this. But it's like being class president. You don't actually have any power. The bankers control everything. Everything. You know, with their all-seeing eyes and their big pyramids and what have you. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you try. It just doesn't work. And people tell me that, here's a good idea. Let's give the government a submission. Submission? As far as I know, submission doesn't connote strength. It connotes giving up. I think that's why they call them submissions. You know, we're the government, and we're about to pass this law which nobody likes. We're prepared to take your submissions. Well, of course you're prepared to take our submission, because it means you can just continue to pass the law and give people the illusion that they actually contributed. I've been to heaps of these submission hearings, and almost every single submitter is talking about something that's very relevant, very scary, and exposing scumbaggery. And so naturally, the panel just goes, okay, thank you very much for your submission, and completely ignore it. I love it. I absolutely love it. You know, you can't get over just how corrupt this country is. When you actually look. Now, that's the only reason that anybody I could conceive of would think that this country isn't corrupt, is if they haven't actually looked. It's everywhere you point your eyes. Everywhere. The police, the very, very first arm of enforcement, you try telling them that John Banks is a criminal and ask them to arrest him and privately prosecute him. I've seen the documents. I've seen the letters. No, we're not going to do that. But why not? There was these other guys that were part of a finance company which John Banks signed off on, false financial reports, which wound up losing tens of millions of dollars for their investors. And you arrested the guy and charged him and jailed him, named Peter Hulich, who was one of the three signatories. Because the other two signatories were John Banks, who was, like, at the time virtually the mayor of Auckland and the leader of a major political party, and Don Brash, who's a former governor of the Reserve Rothschild Bank of New Zealand, and was at one point the leader of the National Party, where at the time it was the opposition. Okay, so those two corrupt politicians can sign off a false waiver and let the fall guy take all the blame. That is how this country works. That's how it works. It works beautifully. It's undeniable. It's very effective. And my goodness, is it difficult to get anybody in this country to even sit up and take notice of it. It's actually quite depressing, you know? The mainstream media will cover it to a degree, gloss over it, as they do, and never let any of the proper details come out. It's just not what they do. That's why I get really depressed when you think about the media in this country. Oh, God. Because you can't have massive corruption in the high places and have an honest media in the same sentence. You know, it just doesn't happen. Because the corrupt media cover up for the corrupt politicians. All right? It's a perfect circle. They got no responsibility to journalism. I've never even been trained in journalism, and I've still got more responsibility to it than they do. Just sick of it, man. They really do need to get their Shiite Muslim together. But something tells me that they won't, unless they're absolutely forced to. You know, this is another element, is that you should be telling your government what to do every day. All right, not the other way around. Not the other way around at all. At all. The authority that they presume to have over all of us is merely a fake facade backed up by violence. That's the reason why that fake facade carries on for so long, is because people don't like having violence perpetrated on them just for exposing a fake facade. As I say, it's a perfect cycle. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.
We'll be right back. Everything in my life ain't what it seems. I wear cops just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. I know I care about is sex and violence. And every baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but I let sanity give me the slip.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
All right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vanilla Show. And I'm still waiting on my guest, Karen Hughes, there. We'll get her up in a minute.
If you play for things,
so AFR, if you're on the boards there, just keep in touch with her and connect her to the Skype whenever possible. In the meantime, also wanted to iterate and explain the reason why, in the very start of the show today, it was breaking up a little bit, is because we're uploading a whole bunch of new music to American Freedom Radio, where we're going to replace all of the songs, the intro and outro tracks to this radio broadcast, with nice, summery, happy, vibrant kind of music, because everybody in the United States is currently experiencing winter, and it's as cold as Shiite Muslims. So hopefully that'll start to warm you up as soon as we get all of those tracks plugged in to the schedule. You know, it's just my way of saying, don't worry, I know that it's cold, I know that it's dark, I know that it sucks, but there's summer somewhere, and hopefully you will be able to enjoy it somewhat. Now, we're connecting up Karen right now. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Oh, good to have you with us. All right, well, welcome to the show. We'd like to start this off by just letting you explain a little bit about who you are and what it is you do for the audience.
Okay, so we're live?
We are indeed.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm called the World Bank whistleblower. I'm a lawyer and an economist, and I was inside the World Bank legal department for 21 years. And I managed to ingratiate myself with some of the powers that be. And I started, trying to get these guys to play by the rules, and they didn't like what I was doing. So I just kept doing it, and I've been doing it ever since. I don't know if how much detail you want me to go into.
Well, we have up to 2 hours, so as much detail as you think is necessary to take a layman from zero understanding to comprehension.
All right. Well, fasten your seatbelts, because we're going down a few rabbit holes. The World Bank is in the very center of the international financial system, and I kind of knew what I was getting into, because before I went to the World Bank, I had gotten to know a lawyer who had been there when the treaties to start the World Bank and its sister organization, the International Monetary Fund, were negotiated. That was in 1944. And he gave me the operation manual. And he also told me that in 1968, which is when Robert McNamara became the president of the World Bank, that the place started going to seed. And you know, I was somebody, I'm going to be dating myself by telling you all this. I'm an American. When they said love it or leave it, that was, you know, about the war in Vietnam, I didn't love it. And I was very, very insistent that this, a country that was going to do something like the war in Vietnam, was not going to be my country. So, and you know, I went shopping for a country. This was between my junior and senior year in college. I was one of the people that went to Woodstock. I was actually there at Woodstock. Anyway, so I went and I decided that I was going to leave the country. But first I went back and finished my undergraduate studies. And then I went to Holland and I studied development economics there. I ended up getting something like a PhD without a thesis. And so I could speak Dutch. And Ronnie Brockes, at that point, he was in his 80s, and, you know, I was in my 30s. And I played the cello, and he played the piano, so we would play Beethoven sonatas, and then he would tell me what it was like to be in the legal department of the World Bank. And the thing about the World Bank is, you know, everybody says, oh, the president is the most important position, but it's not. It's the lawyer's job to sit right in the middle of that whole international financial system and to keep everybody in the world on track. And the thing about the World Bank is it's it was created after, just at the very end of World War II, and one of its goals was to prevent World War III. They looked around to see every mistake that had been made, and they tried to overcome those mistakes. And people were motivated because they had seen all of the death and destruction. And so they did some things that would never be approved in this day and age. One of the things they did was, instead of having one nation, one vote, they created a board which would have the countries represented, and the biggest eight countries would each get their own director, and the rest of the countries would have to share a director. So I was there for 20 years, and the man who hired me was a lawyer from Egypt, and his job before he came to the World Bank was general counsel of OPEC, that's the oil exporting countries. So I think, you know, in retrospect, he could tell that I was somebody who was going to be playing by the rules. And he thought that was something that was very important. And so I got to know a lot of the people that were representing their country on the board. And the board tried to appoint me as the general counsel, and they didn't get their way. But in the meantime, when there was a job interview, you know, they brought in an executive search firm. And during my job interview, they said, why are we burning through so many general counsels? They were like going through them one a year. And I said, that's easy. The board is firing them because they're not doing their job. Because you're kind of like a traffic cop. If the president of the World Bank, which had been an American up until then, was not going to listen to the rest of the world, they were going to fire the lawyer and blame the lawyer whose job it was. So anyway, one of the other things about the World Bank is it's a knowledge bank. And so a political scientist named Jacek Kugler, who was the chair of Claremont University's political science department, came to the World Bank with something called a power transition model, which was actually developed in the Department of Defense. What this did was it matched political science with computer simulation. I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to turn off my phone. Let me just, I've got an answering machine. I didn't prepare for this radio broadcast. I think we agreed to it, what, like 20 minutes before we started?
About 30 minutes and you weren't even home, so don't worry, you'll be allowed certain privileges today.
thank you. I've got an answering machine, so that's just gonna manage without me. But anyway, so getting back to this model, what it showed is that if the U.S. didn't play by the rules, it was going to lose its leadership in the world. And it was also predicting that if the U.S. still didn't learn after it lost something called the Gentleman's Agreement, that was an agreement that lasted for 66 years, that the U.S. would appoint the president of the World Bank. And that fell by the boards. Right now there's a president from the U.S., Dr. Jim Kim. But the thing about it is he is not, he had to compete for his job. He was not, there were two other candidates. It wasn't like the U.S. gets to pick. And with the way he's just ignoring everybody, and, you know, this is probably the last time the U.S. is going to be allowed to appoint a president. And what's happening now is really something extremely serious. And that is that the U.S. is not only losing its leadership, but it's losing its currency. The U.S. dollar has been, you know, the international reserve currency. Well, that's not going to last much longer. We're going into something called gold backwardation, which means that the dollar is about to tank. It's about to crash. There is a very brief period of time that we have to kick out the Federal Reserve, because those people are not, I mean, they're a central bank, but they're a private group. And the people behind that group are the ones that have been responsible for untold misery through the centuries. A lot of people think it's the bankers, like the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and, you know, the ones that own the too big to fail banks, like Goldman Sachs and Citibank and, you know, I'm running out of alphabet soup, Deutsche Bank, Wells Fargo. Well, it turns out those people are all one bank. And the reason I know this is because there's a very, very accurate model, again, a model that was done by three mathematicians from the Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. And what they did was they had data on who owns the companies, the 43,000 companies whose shares are traded on the capital markets. And they found out that there's something called a super entity that goes around putting the same directors on all of the boards. It's called interlocking directors. So this group thought nobody was going to find out what they were up to. That group is doing insider trading. They're making what happened with Bernie Madoff look like nothing happened. They're rigging every single commodity that there is, including the price of gold. That's why the price of gold is kept artificially low. It really should be much, much higher. Same thing with silver. Same thing with they rigged the prices on LIBOR, and they've been caught at that. These thugs thought that they could just, you know, buy every single politician in every single country. But it didn't work. It didn't work. A couple of countries threw them out. Hungary threw out their central bankers. So did Iceland. And Costa Rica was smart enough not to have them in the first place. But I have been, luckily, people are starting to listen to me. And so their days in the United States are very, very, very numbered. I would count them on, you know, I think if they're not out in 2 weeks, I would be surprised.
They have had this massive influence for quite some time, built up over the last 100 years of the Federal Reserve System. And we, in fact, were talking about that study you're referring to, which identified the 147 companies that have come together to form a super entity that basically they own 40% of all wealth and they control 60% of all business, which means they control all business on planet Earth to a large degree. And so naturally they need some form of central power broker by which they can institute their scumbaggery over the entire world with impunity. And I think that this is part of what the World Bank and the World Trade Organization and, of course, the World Court, which are more or less only favour these particular corporate scumbags, is really all about. Is what's your analysis of that?
Yes, except when these thugs do their handiwork, they have to put a facade in place, because a lot of people don't realize what they're doing. And especially, you know, they've bought up the media, so they've been lying to people. But the thing is, we've been busy. And when I say we, who do I mean by we? I have been working with a whole network of whistleblowers and countries and good people. They call them white hats, all over the place. They've just been, we've been going from strength to strength. And people, you know, I'm starting to get through to people. It took the longest time. I didn't, you know, I was kind of clueless. I didn't know about the alternative media. So I just kept going back to the, you know, the same usual broadcasting networks. Except that since I went to law school, I know how to document. So I've got, you know, on my website, you can see the correspondence where I ended up writing the American Society of Newspaper Editors to ask them why they weren't telling the American people what was going on. And at the last presidential election, there's a presidential debate commission. they kicked out the League of Women Voters that were trying to run a clean debate to put up something that, you know, it was just all smoke and mirrors to make it look like it was a real debate, but it really wasn't. Yeah, so I documented all of that correspondence. You can see it on my website. And then because I had been given the insider track, I knew what I needed to do to hold the World Bank legally responsible. I bought a World Bank bond, and I sued not only the World Bank, but I sued the company, the auditing company that had been hired by the board. Because don't forget, I've been talking to these people. I've known them. So they you know, they're helping me with this. So the board commissioned a study. It's something called internal control over financial reporting. That means that if a lawyer who's been fired, like me, for trying to stop corruption, is prevented from talking to the audit team, which is what happened, that is against the audit standards. So I've got to all the auditors.
Karen, I'm sorry. We're coming to break now. I'm really enjoying this. We'll be right back in a little bit under 4 minutes, folks.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday. And Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh yeah. Sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah. It's business time. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. My very special guest is Karen Hudes. Is it Hudes or Hudes or Hudes or what is it?
I answer to everything, but it's theoretically Hudes.
Hudes, as opposed to hubris. That's excellent. All right.
That's right.
She's like Hudes is the opposite of hubris of the World Bank. I love it. It's fantastic. You can't make this stuff up. In fact, I just did make it up. Anyway, if you could continue on explaining this this World Bank situation, I'm really quite fascinated by this. I'm really glad to have you on.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be on. I was in the middle of talking about the accountants, but you can't really talk about the accountants until you talk about Elaine Colville, who is a Scottish whistleblower. And she caught the World Bank with its hand in the till in breaking the accounting rules in her department. And, I mean, she is no shrinking violet. I have never met Elaine Colville. I can't wait until I meet her. We've been working together now for like 3 years. And she is really, really sharp. Anyway, so the two of us ended up in the very center of the auditing. You know, the auditors like to police themselves. And we ended up, I think it's called the Financial Reporting Council. And we said, how is it that KPMG and I think Deloitte was auditing, you know, the World Bank has different entities. And one of the entities is the International Finance Corporation, and that's where Deloitte was auditing. Anyway, so we dragged the auditing firms into the middle of that place, and we found out that nobody's home, that these people are not policing themselves. The brethren are letting each other off. And I also went into something called the International Organization of Supreme Audit Institutions. That's the club for all the government auditors. And these people are just sort of, you know, nobody's home. And we've just documented that nobody's home at the center of the financial system. So there's a lot of retrofitting that we're going to be doing. You better believe. We've caught them with their hands in the till. And, yeah, so actually a lot of people find it very improbable that we're still, you know, telling the tale because a lot of people that have gotten this far have ended up, you know, getting dissuaded or bought off or whatnot. But the thing about it is that what we're documenting is it's not the usual whistleblower thing. We're trying to document a cover-up. So our job is a lot easier. And lawyers are supposed to reveal this kind of cover-up. That's our job. I'm just following the rules of professional responsibility for lawyers. So at any given point, if something had come along to derail me, this was going to blow the lid off. It wasn't going to solve any problem. And there isn't any single day that I know something that I haven't told everybody. I'm a blabbermouth. So they're not going to gain anything by taking me out. And one of the things that I realized when I started to understand the magnitude of the problem, I went to a guy called Larry Garrison, who's my PR guy. And that's when they knew that, you know, there was no way that they were going to escape. If something happened to me, he was like my life insurance policy. And they started doing some pretty nasty tricks to him. That's when, you know, I came up with a formula that when I start telling, you know, the novel that's based on the story or even the real story, I don't know how we're going to do it, he gets half the profits. So he had some skin in the game to keep me, you know, going. And don't forget, we're a group of whistleblowers. So they would have had to find each and every one of us, and there isn't anything that one of us knows that the rest of us don't know. So it's not that easy, you know, to cut us off at the knees. We, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, and we've gotten really pretty good at it. We've gotten pretty good at, and so the best way to think of us now is not as whistleblowers. Think of us as a sting operation, because I have been writing all of the 188 embassies. I've visited with the embassies. I've been, you know, at a certain point, and people have given me a lot of really good advice. So, you know, this UK Serious Fraud Office in 2010 called up the Securities and Exchange Commission and the SEC stonewalled. Well, this is not acceptable. So when the UK Parliament started asking for statements, I started telling them that the SEC was stonewalling the Serious Fraud Office. I've gotten three statements up on the website of the UK Parliament. I've testified with the European Parliament, and I brought a very detailed chronology of all of this, including, you know, that the Serious Fraud Office was getting stonewalled by the SEC. And the Serious Fraud Office, the UK Parliament, they took this very detailed chronology and they sent it to the World Bank and said, do you have anything to say for yourself? So the thing has become a sting operation. And the reason I went to the European Parliament, let me step back a few steps. In 2007, the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs wrote a letter asking the audit committee to get involved. And at that point, it was chaired by the French representative, Pierre Duquesne. And Pierre Duquesne turned it into an investigation of something called the Institutional Integrity Department. Well, that department has no institutional integrity, but in any event, that group acted like a goon squad to take out any whistleblower that dared to try to tell the board what was going on. So what happened was, what's his name, that Paul Volcker came in and did a whitewash. And a number of people that were working in the Institutional Integrity Department tried to tell the Volcker panel what was happening. And those people were being, you know, fired, intimidated. It was, and they ended up getting compensated. And there's a group called Common Dreams. I don't know if you know them. They put up a lot of really good documents. One of the documents that they put up was, listen, I'm just going to tell you how things work in the United States. There's a group called the Government Accountability Project. And they like to make it seem like they're helping whistleblowers. No. What they're doing is they're every now and then making feeble attempts to help a whistleblower so they can keep their cover. They're, you know, they're there to trap any whistleblower that comes to them. They tried to ruin my case, but it didn't work. You know, I've got the serious whistleblowers know what they have with the Government Accountability Project. It's the same thing with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. If you've got a real serious problem, the ACLU is going to make sure that you don't get anywhere with it. So you've got all kinds of gatekeepers that are there to trap the unwary whistleblower, and we've documented all of them. We know, you know, we warn each other, we help each other get around these kinds of booby traps. ACLU is, you know, they call me up every now and then, and they ask for a contribution. I say, why would I give a contribution to a booby trap? And, you know, I knew some of the lawyers at the ACLU. I've documented all of these, you know, terrible, the people that work for these organizations should be ashamed of themselves. Anyway, so that's what our group is. We're a sting operation. And it turned out that the real corruption was not in the World Bank. The real corruption, and it's not even, you know, you can say that all of these crooked politicians on the take, that the corruption is there. No, I can tell you where the corruption is. It's not even with the bankers. I mean, yeah, they're corrupt. I'm not saying that these groups are not corrupt. But there's, you know, it was kind of like taking an elevator up. Every time you would finish documenting all of the corruption at that level, all of a sudden the elevator would go up another layer. So let me tell you what's behind the banksters. It's the Jesuits. Yeah, it's the Jesuits.
Well, what's the name? The Vatican is one of the biggest banking institutions in the world, isn't it?
That's right. So and, you know, people get very, very angry at the Rothschilds and the other families that are involved there. And I'm not trying to condone these groups. But I have to say that it is the Jesuits that are giving them the marching orders. And don't forget it. Because there's, you know, as this story is coming out, I'm looking at some very nasty videos because the Jesuits are very good at finding scapegoats. And they're, you know, they're very busy putting out their disinformation. We shouldn't make the same mistakes this time around.
Well, let's get into this after the break. The break that's coming, of course, because I think that there has been a lot of people recently coming out talking about the Jesuits and their current influence of the world, and this is met by denial and, oh, you're a religious fundamentalist or something of this nature. But the unfortunate business is you can't argue with documented evidence,
exactly,
ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly, and we've got it. Yeah.
Exactly. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Ladies and gentlemen, please donate to the show if you like the idea of bringing on people from all over the world, whistleblowers, activists and whatnot, to share their stories with zero cost to them, preferably. Free information. I think that's a good way to override this public education nightmare, which has dumbed everybody down so they don't realize that there's a bunch of criminal bankers and Jesuits in control of the world. We'll be right back. ladies and gentlemen, is hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Particularly if the radiation levels in New Zealand are so high that you have a part-time job as an eco light bulb. And my very special guest is Karen Hudez, the one who exposed the hubris of the World Bank. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Vinny.
Mm. Can we get into the Jesuits now? What are the Jesuits?
They are the military arm of the Vatican. And they have been thrown out of, I think, about 80 countries. And they were thrown out of the United States after they finished assassinating Lincoln. But guess who brought them back? Ronald Reagan.
Why did he do that?
Well, you know, there's speculation that he was never the same after that assassination attempt on his life. Some people
Hold on a second. Let me get this straight. He was traumatized after getting nearly assassinated, so he invites assassins into his country to make himself feel better.
Some people say that the Ronald Reagan that emerged after that assassination attempt had been programmed.
Hmm. Has he got any personal history in the background? Were you Jesuit training as a child or anything like that?
No, but he was nearly dead, and some people said that, you know, what happened was a puppet after he came back.
Well, I would argue that every U.S. president since Kennedy has been a puppet since the moment they started.
Yeah. And by the way, what Kennedy was doing, he was assassinated by the Jesuits, and what he was doing was he had signed, 10 days before his assassination, he had signed something called the Green Hilton Agreement. Hilton, like the hotel. That was going to have U.S. dollars backed by gold and just throw the Fed out. And they couldn't have that, so they killed him instead. And this gold that was going to back the dollars when they were assassinating Kennedy, well, this gold has now been promised back to the United States. I'm in touch with the man who's got the signature authority. There's a lot of gold that people don't know about. There's 170,500 metric tons of gold in the vault of the Bank of Hawaii, and that's the gold that's there to back U.S. dollars. And by the way, there's uncut U.S. dollars. We just have to, as a people, tell those rotten banks that they are not allowed to, you know, to imprison our country any longer. We're taking our country back and we're taking our currency back. Very simple. And we're going to do that in very short order. Anyway, let me tell you about the rest of the gold. There's 130,500 metric tons in Amex Hong Kong. There's 150,000 metric tons in Development Bank of Singapore. That's a total of 451,000 metric tons. That's what? More than double the amount that people think is on, you know, existence. But I'm not finished. There's another 100,000 metric tons in other assorted American banks. And there's 172,000 metric tons buried in the Philippines. It's been reburied. They dug it up during World War II. There was Yamashita. That is a Japanese general. And the father of Yamashita is a guy who's descended from the brother of Queen Victoria. She had a twin, and they sent him off to the Philippines because he had, you know, Asperger's or something or other. The people in England didn't think he was going to make a suitable king. So he was sent off, but he went around the world siring children. And guess who one of his kids was?
Oh, I don't know.
Hitler.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, but getting back to the gold. So this gold, at a certain point, it went to the Vatican. And people have been earning a lot of money on this wealth. You can imagine. And they've been having a field day with it. Everybody's been ignorant of it, but it's now, and it was there for the benefit of humanity. And those crooks have been using our gold for their benefit. They had no right to it.
Can we see that the gold standard might not work in terms
right.
of the economic
solution? Not the gold standard, by the way. It can any. It can be any commodity. It doesn't have to be a precious metal. For Ecuador, it can be bananas. It's anything of value. And the reason why we want to do that is because there should not be interest charged on countries' currency. And if it's supported by something, an asset, something of value, then the government just issues it, and it's there. It's not, people have to pay interest on it to bankers. That's the difference. It's very straightforward.
I spoke to Tom Filer, who works on Wall Street and sells commodities in a very honorable and transparent fashion in order to diversify people's gold and silver holdings with real commodities like land, food, etc. And what he told me is that 99% of the gold that's currently in circulation is just paper. It doesn't really exist. Is that true?
Yes, that's how they're keeping the price artificially low. They're doing something called naked shorting. They're manipulating the price of gold. But something, you know, the thing about gold is that it's got some very special characteristics, and there are economists that specialize in the monetary economics of gold. One of them is a man named Anto Feketa. He's a Hungarian, and he was the one that's pointed out in July 7th, central banks usually lease out their gold. And they stopped doing it because it was going to be too expensive. The lease price was too expensive because people were losing their faith in the paper dollars. And at a certain point, people who are holding gold will refuse to sell the gold for paper currency at any price. And we're getting close to that point.
What happens when that occurs to the global economy?
I can tell you, I used to be, I worked in Argentina. I worked for the U.S. Export-Import Bank before I came to the World Bank, and I was in Argentina in the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s. And what happens is the prices double overnight, and you have to keep adding zeros at the end of the currency. And you're just counting out dollar bills, you're just flipping through them, you know, to buy a banana. It's not a pleasant situation to be in when currency collapses. And we're very, very close to that with the dollars. If you look at a graph that I sent to... Let me tell you, by the way, what our authorities know about this. They know everything about it. All of the governors of the 50 states. I've been writing to all of the attorneys general. And there's a special group of governors called the Council of Governors. My governor, Martin O'Malley, I live in Maryland, is one of the co-chairs. And so the other co-chair is Terry Branstad. And then the president of the National Governors Association is Jack Markell. He's from Delaware. He's on that council. I've been writing those guys. I've been telling them, and I just sent them a little graph showing how the dollars are about to collapse. And the countries of the world, by the way, they're refusing to accept dollars anymore. And the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they are not using dollars when they trade among themselves. And if there's at the end of the accounting period, they're settling the difference in gold. So dollars are about to crash. There's no way that the Federal Reserve can do anything to prevent that. They're the ones that were causing it. And what they want is they want people to be panicked and go to their FEMA camps. They've been trying to do all kinds of stupid, they call them false flags, to panic people. And we have gotten ahead of them, and we've warned people. So Syria didn't happen. There was supposed to be an event on the 8th of October. There was a nuclear bomb that was all set to go off in Charleston, and two of the senior naval authorities made sure that the bomb detonated 600 miles off the coast of South Carolina, and they were fired for their trouble. But I'm just saying, this isn't working, so now the banksters have to come up with something. I think, I was just listening on the radio, I think they're now trying to start a war with China. I mean, they're just clueless, these idiots. They are totally clueless. They're just like the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. Remember that little old wizened man in the projection booth?
Oh,
Frank
yeah.
Frank Baum, who wrote that story, was writing about monetary economics and wanted to put it that way. And I'll tell you, the World Bank whistleblowers are Toto, and we have pulled the curtain back, and you can see that little wizened old man and what he's doing. And he's the projection screen, that's the mainstream media that the banksters own and the Vatican owns. Yeah, but it's not
so,
working.
So can anymore. I ask, just clarification, those officials within the U.S. administration that know about the coming currency collapse, are they covering it up because they're too afraid that people will find out and it'll collapse sooner, or are they covering it up because they don't want it to collapse just yet and they want all their power and control mechanisms in order to get people in the FEMA camps faster in place
first? No, you haven't figured out where we are on this. Where we are on this is that the coalition that I'm telling you about exists, and we have taken control. We have won. We've won. And now they're just sort of scrambling and going, blah, 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 blah. That's what they're doing. I mean, if you were in the control tower for these idiots, you could see they're trying to put out fires and running around like chickens without heads because we have won. We're the ones in control. I can show you the email that I sent to these idiots. No, the people are taking back all of their gold, and we're in charge. And, you know, in a matter of days. Because people understand what these thugs are, they see them, and there's nowhere for these idiots to go.
Well, I'd say some of the population certainly sees what's happening, but I fear that the bulk of the population is completely unaware of this entirely. And that's kind of includes myself.
Okay, let me tell you how it works, all right? This power transition model that I'm telling you about, it came out of the Department of Defense, right? Chuck Hagel was the senator of Nebraska in 2008. When I spoke to him about this model, I have the letter that I wrote to then the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Charles Grassley, where I was describing my conversation with the Secretary of Defense. So I got in touch with the group. First I went to the Inspector General of the Department of Defense. And I said, you know, you've got a little problem going on here with the fact that you've got the Fed trying to ruin what is national security. We're going to lose NATO because this model is very accurate. I said, we're going to lose NATO. You had better get this corruption under control. You know that this transition power model is 90 to 95% accurate. You can see where we are. I said, here's my correspondence with all of the countries of the world. I've been on Russian television today three times. I've gotten all kinds of statements up in, there's a website in Germany which has 1.5 million readers per month. And in that interview that's up there, they were asking me about the military helicopter that buzzed the U.S. consulate in Frankfurt. They said, Karen, what does it mean? I said, I think you were trying to get our attention, aren't you? And I take that conversation and I give it to the Department of Defense. And I say, if you want NATO, you know what's good for you. You're going to kick out this stupid Federal Reserve. That's how this model works. Are you getting the picture?
Well, NATO appears to me to simply be the world army. Let's back up a little second here. So we've got this banking cartel that's currently trying to keep its agenda on track, and they're failing. My fear is
there is no agenda. There is no agenda.
There's no agenda by the bankers to take over the world monetarily?
They would have been in control if their agenda was working. The BRICS countries said, no, we're not having a single currency. Forget it. Go take a hike. So that didn't work. Then they had this idea to have some kind of a martial law introduced. That didn't work. The bomb didn't go up. One of their stupid plans, they told all of the members of Congress to get on four military aircraft and fly to Florida for the funeral of one of the members of Congress. So we found out about it. There's a group called Able Danger. I mean, I've been working with all kinds of really fascinating groups. So Able Danger sent them a note saying, if you get on those planes, one of three things is going to happen. They're going to go to a prison and we're going to put all of the members of Congress in jail for being traitors. That's a possibility. The planes could fly to Guantanamo Bay. That's a possibility. They could also crash. So the members of Congress did not get on those planes. 30 of them did. That's all. We are foiling their attempts at, you know, it's just their business is not going as usual.
All right. We'll be right back after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Gentlemen, to the show that is broadcasting somewhere over the horizon in New Zealand, and we're talking about the man behind the curtains. I think that's quite an appropriate song to have at this particular juncture. Now, what we were discussing over the break, Karen, was about how the White Hat Society, and I believe there was a whistleblower named Drake who came out earlier, it might have been last year or the year before, saying that they're going to overturn and expose the New World Order and that we're going to win and we're going to jail all the bankers. And there were two reactions from people, maybe three. Reaction number one, okay, great, it's all over. I don't have to do anything anymore because somebody's got it well in hand. Two, I don't believe it. It must be a scam to try and make us all stand down. Or three, hey, these people have really got something here. How can I help? How can I contribute to making my world less dominated by scumbaggery? I wanted to have this discussion with you upon these different perspectives here.
Well, yes, you can, but I'm going to ask for the prerogative of a guest. That was one of my favorite songs. Would you mind if I just sang a couple of bars from it?
Go for your life.
Birds fly over the rainbow. Why then, oh, why can't I? Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the birds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. Okay, that's enough.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know.
I could have sang for the rest of the night. But anyway, I'll spare your listeners. Okay. Now, I was thinking about, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about the best way to describe it, to answer it. Think about a heart patient that just, you know, had a heart attack, was dragged into the operating room, had surgery, managed just barely to hang on. Okay? That's where we're going to be once we get things straightened out with these bankers. Now, do you think we should, the people that are listening, we're all in this together. Do you think you can just sort of sit back while that poor, you know, next to a corpse is trying to recover? I mean, everybody's got to do their bit. And the thing is, we're not going to get it right because we have been in dire straits. I mean, just think about it. Think about all of the terrible food that we've been eating for all these years. I mean, think about the terrible inferior education we've been getting. Think about all the starving people in, you know, in various places. I mean, we have got to really, everybody's got to pitch in. And the hard part is that since we've been, you know, flailing around, being tormented by these, you know, and we have to take our responsibility for it. I mean, have we been working hard to understand what's going on? Some of us have. I mean, I'll tell you, it's been amazing the way we've all been pulling together. But we've been doing the heavy lifting, and we could use some help.
What kind of help? I mean, because you use that analogy of the heart patient. A coronary surgeon has nurses and such, and he goes, scalpel, mop my brow, give me this clamp that blood flow over there. I mean, what would you be directing the nurses to do right about now?
No, we are the patient.
The White Hat Society is the patient that needs our help?
I'm saying all of humanity is that patient.
Okay. But you're taking the spear tip straight into these people. So what is it that people can actually do to help you and the White Hats and the whistleblowers to further your cause?
Well, the very first thing is to start figuring out what part you've played in this whole drama. I mean, we've landed up on the operating table. We're not dead yet. And so everybody who's going to start pitching in to get the patient up and recovered, the first thing to do is to sit back and to figure out whether you were part of the disease or whether you were part of the group that was trying, you know, to get better. And be very candid with yourself, because if you're going to do something good going forward, you have to figure out where you were and what it is that you have to do differently. So the very first thing is, and don't do it by yourself, because nobody wants to be honest with themselves. I mean, for me, the best way for me to be effective was I had to sit there and see where it was that I was just deluding myself. What difficult truths I was trying to avoid. And my sisters can tell you about those. You know, they weren't very pretty, and it wasn't very much fun for me to see myself as the person I really was. But luckily, you know, my sisters stuck with me and told me who I was and what I was doing wrong. And I, you know, I'll give myself credit. I did actually try to see what they were telling me and understand it. And once you go through that kind of a personal understanding, then you're not going to be duped by the next person that's telling you to do things that are really quite destructive to yourself. I mean, you don't want your world to be a terrible world for your children. And if you're one of those people who says, I could care less and I just want it here for me, I'm going to say something on this broadcast that I don't usually say. But I'm a person who was lucky enough to have, as one of my friends, a person who died and then didn't die. Bashir Sulal, he was run over, he had a motorcycle, he was run over, he died in the ambulance, and then he came back and he told me about it. So, you know, you've got nowhere to go. Just think about it.
Yeah, I think this is the reason why I do what I do with the shows and interviewing people like yourself, is because my theory is, if these people aren't stopped, these evil scumbags, I'm freaking dead. You're freaking dead. We're all freaking dead. They'll kill the whole world before they let loose their grip on power, unless we stop them. You know, I mean, I don't really see much of a choice in this. You know, what other career prospects have I got? Oh, I'm going to sell telecommunications. What, telecommunications for one of these giant New World Order companies that are going to be used to surveil all the people that you're selling the product to in exchange for thousands of dollars a month? No, I can't do that. I can, on the other hand, help people who need some coverage to get their ideas out there so that all of this corrupt system in its entirety gets exposed. Because it's not just the banking system, it's not just the medical system or the politicians, it's everything. It's the everything system. Everything everywhere seems to me to be totally fracked. So that means everybody everywhere needs to be doing their part in order to expose it, bring it to public consciousness, and then solve it, right? There's not very much point in trying to solve a problem that you don't understand, but there's not very much point in trying to understand a problem that you're not trying to solve.
Yeah. Well, at this point, everybody, I think, is pretty much riveted to this recognition that we are at the moment of recognition. Enough of us see what's going on. Enough of us are there to do that transformation, and that's where we're at. It's a very exciting moment. It's a wonderful moment. I think we should all relish it, you know, because we've actually, that's what I meant when I said we've won. No, we've got a lot of recovering to do. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying we are at the point where we all see where it is, or enough of us see where it is that we can show the rest of us. And that's what we have to do.
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, this has been something I've been saying for years, is that we've already won. We're simply going through the motions. The victory that we needed and the victory that we now are simply capitalizing on is a public awakening. And there is a big public awakening. That's what we needed to start happening in order to get our goals listened to and then indeed implemented. We couldn't actually do anything without this mass public awakening now. I mean, shows like mine exist because there's a mass public awakening and people are able to contribute. The White Hat Society exists because there's a public awakening and people actually understand the material that you're coming out. I mean, if you came out and tried to tell everybody this kind of stuff in, say, 1973, nobody would have any idea what you were talking about and you'd vanish into obscurity. But now you're catapulting into almost a version of underground superstardom because of the mass awakening.
Okay, let me tell you where I am on this. I am one of the surfers. We've been riding this curling wave. There's a whole slew of us, all of us, you know, and the ones that have been, you know, in the background but doing the heavy lifting know very, very well who they are. So, you know, it's been, and a lot of people have had to really, you know, pull me back from doing the wrong thing. It's been a group effort from, you know, soup to nuts.
Yeah. Well, I found that there's a lot of elders in this movement who have been exposing this kind of material for decades upon decades. Without their diligence in those early years, we wouldn't have anything to. We wouldn't even have any legs to stand on. We probably would be far, far back in the game at this particular point.
And you do have to stand upon the shoulders of giants sometimes in order to touch the sky.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's important to pay homage as often as is reasonable to these people, because it's sort of like the Greatest Generation, who died in World War II so that we could have our freedoms preserved, allegedly, even though it was just kind of, you know, a staged war that wound up reducing the population and getting a whole bunch of very nasty banking and international governance measures like the UN and World Bank instituted. But at the end of the day, that belief was there that those people died.
The World Bank has been a very important... if I wasn't able to go to all of those countries and contact them over a period of time, we wouldn't have a solution. I'm not saying that the World Bank has got to continue, but I'm saying that it is a platform that we can use to go forward with. You've got to convene the parties. You've got to prevent this gold backwardation. Do you see what I'm saying? I'm not saying that we want one currency in the world. Absolutely not. But I'm saying that if we don't have a place to convene all the parties so that they understand that this is a turning point and that there is a consensus for humanity to take back its own wealth, then we wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we need to get the discussion going, don't we? We need the discussion to continue.
It's the forum for the discussion. It's ours now. It's our institution. I've spoken to all the World Bank whistleblowers to ask them whether that place has got to be trashed, or whether if we all went back as a group, if we could get that place to fly right enough so that we could move to the next thing that everybody wants. And everybody agrees, yes, it's something that's it's what you call the global public commons. If you didn't have those crooks intimidating everybody with their institutional integrity department, then people inside the place, if they felt comfortable blowing the whistle when things were going badly, you could get that thing straightened up enough so that you could get from point A to point B.
Mm. So at this particular point in time, I mean, what's your next move? Are you going to conferences or this kind of thing? Are you in a recruiting process? What?
Well, the number one thing that we all have to work on is getting the currencies functional. We have got to take the Federal Reserve notes and ignore them and issue dollars that are backed by this gold that the person who's got the authorized signatory power has given to us. We have to believe that it's there for us to use, and we've got to get that happening. That's very important. And what people who are listening to this can do is they can get, if they're American, they can get in touch with their county executives and have their county executives get in touch with their governors. And they can issue, they can have their states recognize gold and silver as
Karen,
currency.
All right, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
Right here, it's paradise.
If you place a thing in the center of your life that lacks the power to nourish, it will eventually poison everything that you are and destroy you. As simple a thing as an idea or your perspective on yourself or the world, no one can be the source of your content. It lies within, in the center.
I'll be with Mellow while you're thinking of to slide through. Only with Mellow while you're thinking of to slide through.
Don't let nothing ride you.
If the sun or the moon should give way to die,
they would immediately go out.
One, swallow, don't make a sound.
But tomorrow has to start somewhere.
Newspapers entertain. Lion tamers die in pain. This child wise beyond words.
Welcome back.
ladies and gentlemen, as the final segment here. It's been a very quick show. Karen, we've only got about 10 minutes left. I'd like to get some of your personal background. I mean, growing up as a child, did you think any of this kind of stuff would happen to you? Or did you think that the system was the lie? Did you think that the lie about the system being good and being there for everybody was true for a period of time?
Well, you know, my parents knew that they were in for it with me. As a little baby, as soon as I could stand up, they called me Mussolini because I would just go on and on, you know, like I have tonight, just giving speeches. That was what I did in my crib. And I have to tell a story. I had a really great family life. I mean, my parents are really great. And my father was a small businessman. He had a grocery store, and he would take me to his store, and I would be a cashier. And when I was four or something, he did something I didn't like, and I didn't really know what to do, but I was very, very angry. And I hauled off, and I socked him where it hurt. He knew he was in for trouble with me then. I mean, I really hurt him. I was really mad. And something gave me the idea that that was the way to make my point. So, yeah. But, I mean, I was captain of the NYU fencing team. I have never been a shrinking violet. I mean, that's just my nature. And when things happened that I didn't like, I was not afraid to let people know. So, you know, and the 60s, that was a perfect time, if that's the kind of person you were, to be involved in that.
Well, I think it was the opportune moment, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I was just talking to my mother. She's going to be 90, and she was going on. She's now in an assisted living facility, and she was complaining about some of the hairdos. And I said, Ma, you forgot what I used to do. I had an Angela Davis wig.
I'm not even familiar with Angela Davis. See, I wasn't even conceived back in the 60s.
Okay, well,
hey.
Google Angela Davis, and you'll see what kind of wig I had.
Somebody tells me this will be a very shocking one. Yeah. Hey, isn't it funny how fashions change, eh? And I find it's like, though, the more things change. Oh my God, that's an Angela Davis wig? Me? Jesus. That's like the biggest afro I've ever seen.
That's
like the death row. That's like the death row of afros, bro.
That's what I used to wear.
I mean, as the gays would say, that's out of control.
That's right.
Well, I'm glad to see that you haven't changed much.
That's right.
Well, see, this is another thing as well. I'm glad to see that you're still having fun with all of this because you're dealing with some of the most serious scum that this earth has ever seen. And how are you keeping your sanity amidst all of this? How are you preventing yourself from becoming paranoid?
Because I'm surrounded by wonderful people.
Is that it?
Yeah.
I guess that's pretty straightforward, hey? Because if you've got good reinforcing energy and good reinforcing people around you at all times, you can never be isolated. And as far as I know, that's how psychopaths really treat their victims, is in order to victimize them properly, you need to get them isolated away from anybody who would help them or give them emotional support or anything like that. So you've kind of thwarted them in that perspective.
Or look what they've done with putting some of the prisoners in solitary confinement. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I think Dean Clifford has been arrested again. And last time he was arrested, they kept him in solitary confinement for a number of months. To the point where even the guards started to feel sorry for him. And they come up trying to talk to him, and the cellar's like, "Hey, man, are you okay? Do you need anything?" He's like, "No, no, I'm good. Bugger off." It's just like you realize soon enough, and it doesn't matter how many bad things are planned to, shall we say, detach you from your sanity, detach you from your humanity. If you don't give up, and if you simply dig your heels in, there's very little that can stop you achieving your objectives, is there?
Yeah.
Now, if we're going to take out these bankers, what would you suggest would be the appropriate punishment? Because every crime deserves some form of punishment. Would you agree?
I was talking to some people about that, and I was saying that, to me, probably the best punishment is to let them walk down the street and have people look at them and know who they are.
I recall when I was a child, I had a whole group of kids attack me. I think I had like about maybe 10 kids trying to beat me up, and I bit one of them, and it scared them all off. You know, they went running. And said, "Oh my God, this boy is biting us!" And so they all went off and complained to the principal. And this is a Catholic school, and the principal hung a sign around my neck that said "dog bite," and marched me through the school while the whole school made fun of me. That wasn't a very nice experience. It'd be nice to see that happen to a banker.
Yep.
Yeah. Sign around their neck that says "banker." I mean, do you remember that movie Braveheart, where William Wallace was being trundled into the square where he was about to be tortured and killed, and people threw rotten fruits and vegetables at him of some kind? I think that could be actually be quite a cathartic experience, you know? I think you just imagine, you know, a tomato squelching on the side of David Rockefeller's head. Mm-hmm. Maybe a can of beans or something here or there, you know, nobody knows. But yeah. Anyway, coming down to the last of it, do you have any final pieces of advice for anybody who's currently in your position to garner other whistleblowers to come forward? But to come forward in such a way that they're actually protected and don't become the victims of the system that they're trying to expose.
Well, you know, most of the best advice to whistleblowers is don't become a whistleblower because it's not for the faint-hearted. But I think now that we've succeeded in exposing these, you know, banking practices, I think the main thing is for people to protect their whistleblowers. Yeah, because you need to know what's going on, and that's really the only way to find out is for people on the inside to tell you. And if they're going to tell you, you have to protect them.
How does one go about protecting a whistleblower? I mean,
good job of it. Look what's happening to Beverly Manning. Yeah, I mean, you have to make it clear that you find it unacceptable for people who give you information that you need to know for those people to be retaliated against and punished. In the case of the World Bank whistleblowers, the U.S. Congress has passed legislation that says that the U.S. contribution to the capital increase will not be dispersed until the effects of retaliation against whistleblowers have been eliminated. So the Congress did its part. But that's not getting enforced. Yeah, it's not getting enforced. It needs to be. And we whistleblowers at the World Bank need to go back and, you know, straighten up that place and get things rolling for the rest of the world. And we have the countries of the world that are sitting there that can, you know, you can hold your politicians to account in each country that's listening to this broadcast. You know, if you want to know what I wrote to your executive director on the board, I can tell you I've been writing these guys, you know, since 2004. And lately I've been writing them, you know, 2-3 times a month, sometimes more often when they need it, than cheering them on.
It's kind of like When you were saying that, I sort of thought for a moment that you were writing constant letters to the directors of reserve banks all around the world. And it kind of reminded me of The Shawshank Redemption. Have you seen that movie?
No, I didn't. No, I'm not writing the private bankers. I'm writing the ones inside the World Bank whose job it is to clean up the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and protect the bondholders who own World Bank bonds. See, that's where I've got the law in every single country of the world, because the World Bank has sold $180 billion worth of bonds. That's the law that I'm getting everybody to enforce.
Hmm. Well, I'm very glad that you are doing the work you're doing, Karen. And if you keep sending those letters constantly, eventually it'll sink in, and they'll do what you want them to do and ask
That's
you to
right.
please stop sending us letters.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
All right. Harassment by mail does work, ladies and gentlemen. Don't disparage it. Thank you, Karen. It's been lovely. And do you have a website, just quickly?
Yes. KAHUDES.NET. And thanks for having me, Vinny.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been my honor, pleasure, and various other nice adjectives, too. And we'll see you again sometime, Karen, and we'll see you again sometime, too. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening.
To hurt you.